Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 40. Right at the beginning of paper 40, which is old single column, page 443. All right, and this is the last paper in this block of papers. As if you've been following the group for a long time, one of the things I've been helping everyone appreciate that the book is broken up into blocks of papers. You have the parts, and then blocks, and then the papers. Yeah, so you have three levels of a hierarchy of organization of the text. And this is the last of this block of papers on the universes of beings, in the sense of, remember part two started out with a block on the local universes themselves, and then you get this whole series of papers on those universes of beings, and then we'll do a couple papers on the universes of things, so you do the beings and the things aspect within the local universes, these fundamental building blocks of the universe of universes. And if you've been reading the book from the beginning, and you've been reading and wondering, well, are they ever going to talk about me? Gone through a lot of papers, and I'm still looking for me. Where's the paper about me? Well, we're finally here, okay? We finally got to the paper that's about where we're immediately trying to synchronize into the ascending sons of God. We're not technically ascending the sons of God right now. We're faith sons of God. But our immediate path is as an ascending mortal, and sure enough, it takes, if you count the forward, you've gone through 40 papers to finally get to this point. So that should be telling you something, when it's pretty immediately obvious that they've been going top down, and taking a look at, and looking at the universe of universes. We are finally at the bottom of the stack, okay, where we begin. As you see, they'll mention, this is, we start at the lowest level of any being that can potentially synchronize with eternity and, ascend to the paradise isle and have a career on the other side of that that ascension. So let's see, I think that's probably all we need for an intro. Let's just get in and see, they start off with another set of seven, and they'll give us little vignettes about the other element, participants in that group of seven, but one of them is us. All right.
Paper 40, The Ascending Sons of God. As in many of the major groups of universe beings, seven general classes of ascending sons of God have been revealed. 1. Father-fused mortals. 2. Son-fused mortals. 3. Spirit-fused mortals. 4. Evolutionary seraphim. 5. Ascending material sons. 6. Translated midwayers. 7. Personalized adjusters.
Okay, so just, there's one thing to remind you. I mean, it's all straightforward there, just a list, basically. But, just to remind you again, what kind of a seven is this? We have two basic sevens that come into play. Is it the sevenfoldness that that takes us around the universe of universes? The one that gives rise to seven super universes, the seven master spirit sevenfold pattern, or is it the one that's orthogonal to that? Is it the one that you find when you go radially out from the Isle of Paradise instead of going around? Is it the one that matches up with the seven circuits of Avona? You know, is it the one that's tied to the Trinity? You know, remember, we have this basic coupling between the infinite spirit and the Paradise Trinity that is powering all of this unfolding of beings. And so you have a sevenfoldness on each side of that twofold generator, one on the infinite spirit side, giving rise to the seven master spirits, and one on the Paradise Trinity side, giving rise to lots and lots of the sevens that we see in these groups of beings, like this group of beings. In some way, these seven categories are linked to the seven circuits. You know, one of these is tied to the first circuit, one's tied to the second, etc. And you could attempt to try to figure out what that synchronization is. Right? You know, like I've said that many times, and it's not always very immediately apparent, but it's there. In one way or another, it is tied to those seven circuits, despite the fact that you might be initially kind of biased to think, well, when I think about the seven master spirits, they always tell me, give them to me in the order, first master spirit, second, and the first one has the flavor of deity for his nature that's associated with the Father, the second one with the Son, the third one with the Spirit. Now, when you see this Father, Son, Spirit, and you're thinking, well, maybe, but then try to keep it going, and it's like, well, okay, evolutionary seraphim, is that Father, Son? It doesn't seem like it, and then ascending material sons, is that Father, Spirit? It does, sounds a little suspicious that it's not, and it isn't. So I definitely wanted to re-stress that, just because you could be thrown and then just launch into a very complex rationalization scheme to try to get 4, 5, 6, and 7 to match into the pattern, right? But it's not. It's the circuits of Avona. I mean, that's, we figured that out when we were going through paper 30 and all these various lists of groups of beings, that those, it was lots and lots of sevens, and those sevens are tied to the sevenfold of a Havona, tied to the Paradise Trinity. And the other little thing, to remind yourself, because it's just right there, seven general classes of the ascending sons of God have been revealed. Okay? We talked about that too when we were in paper 30. That's the interesting thing, that they can create a subset of all of the beings. They can take a cross section through all of that, and that almost uncountable number of different categories of beings. And when you take this slice where it's, you produce a self-contained story where the Urantia book has everything you need to fill out a picture. There's no holes, And in that, even though it's not telling you everything, the sevens are there. So you have this sevenfoldness, obviously, at a number of levels, where if they revealed more, you would have, more sevens, in order to have a complete story there. But the fact that you, in order to get a complete story, even if it's not all of the beings, you still get seven. It's just very significant to reflect on how finely crafted reality is like that. That you can take such a tiny subset of everything and still it's complete. It's complete at many levels.
Come on, seven.
Yeah. Right? That fact that it has many, many levels of completeness, we've seen that even. Remember how we have all these different ways that you can ascend and come into relationship with things, and they'll call, a level that being reaches some level of completeness, like we just read in the previous one. We had the core of seraphic completion. Okay? Yeah, and see, the reason that you can have all these different levels of completion is because that's the way the universe is constructed. It has this amazing hierarchical wholeness, not just a simplistic, you know, wholeness, where it's you know, infinity or nothing. There's wholeness, you know, obviously in the fullness of the cosmos infinite, at an infinite number of levels, there's a wholeness. So that fundamental, fully transcendent wholeness penetrates down into this infinite hierarchy of reality and expresses itself at every level. Yeah. It has that transcendent engagement. It doesn't just engage at the top, it doesn't just engage at the bottom, it engages at every level, and so every level has a measure of wholeness to it. So even right here, you know, on this planet, and you're just beginning, you're not even technically an ascending sun yet, you're just a faith sun, it's possible for you to achieve some initial level of wholeness. Okay?
Not likely, but possible.
Well,
I'm being facetious.
But how likely, though, in a way, is it?
That's a good question.
That initial thread of encirclement of the Holy Spirit that the Creative Mother Spirit gave you by grace?
It's there.
It's a measure of wholeness. Okay? There's even a measure of wholeness clear down there. See, at that lowest level that, by and large, humans are completely oblivious to. There's a wholeness there that you could strike step with. A starting point of wholeness that was given to you by grace. But what does it say in Paper 16, Section 6? It's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch take delight in cultivating the kind of a consciousness that would even begin to synchronize with what was given to you by grace, which is whole, you know, let alone go build on levels of wholeness above that. Those any cosmic level, when they say cosmic level, those are levels of wholeness. Every psychic circle level is a level of wholeness, you know. Whenever they use the word cosmic, that means a wholeness, you know, and that's, you know, that's a very sad thing indeed, that people go through their whole life feeling broken, disconnected, you know, and it's just waiting for you right there. All you have to do is just allow that initial gift of grace to be where you stand, and your life will find a new stability, a new wholeness that it never had before, let alone if you genuinely, you know, really get into taking delight and cultivating and start going somewhat above that first level. But, you know, the way Jesus would, you know, the way he did kind of rephrase that sad to record line was when he talked about how people are building on sand instead of on rock. You know, that's what he meant. You know, to build on rock is to build on that initial level of wholeness, which is stable. It's upheld by the, you know, the mother. You can stand on it, it'll be stable. If any life on that platform is a stable life. It's a real life. It's a, you know, when they say really living, that's what they mean. You know, trying to somehow, you know, keep from sinking into the quicksand is not really living. So, all these things work together. I kind of wanted to stretch that out a bit, just to point out that you can take the most vanilla boilerplate-looking thing, you know, like this couple words and a list of seven, and if you reflect on it, you can launch into a whole kind of consciousness-transforming period of genuine consciousness. You know, to not think about that is to not be really living. You need to take delight in cultivating. Being like that, seeing reality wherever you look, instead of just waiting for some sort of transcendent mountaintop thing, you know, to make a difference in your life. It doesn't matter how lowly the world seems around you, there's some foundation of cosmos that you can stand on if you look for it. Yeah. there isn't any level that's too low to be upheld. Okay, so don't pine for some future. You know, find the now that has been given to you. All right, let's see what they say as they get into the details here.
The story of these beings, from the lowly animal origin mortals of the evolutionary worlds to the personalized adjusters of the Universal Father, present a glorious recital of the unstinted bestowal of divine love and gracious condescension throughout all time and in all universes of the far-flung creation of the paradise deities.
Wow. Okay, it's a beautiful little poetic flourish to start with, but notice the word that maybe kind of jumped out a little bit more than, you know, because of what I just said. See, condescension, okay? Descends down, con, to be with you where and as you are, okay? You don't have to go up. God has come down. And most importantly, the God that can come down is the vertical hierarchy expression of God. The Father is up at the top and can't come down. The God that can come down that you can stand on is God the Mother, that cosmos made being. Okay? That's the condescension, that gracious condescension. Find her and stand on her, you know, rather than trying to somehow magically leap from here to eternity so that you can supposedly stand on the Father. Right? Stand on the God that's condescended down to you. All right, and it's, you know, in the unstinted, you know, the poetry of all that, glorious recital of the unstinted bestowal. And as we see, as we start getting into the list here, you'll find they'll try to remind you, even though they're finally going to talk about you, that some of that poetry is not about you.
Yep.
All right.
These presentations began with a description of the deities, and group by group, the narrative has descended the universal scale of living beings until it has reached the lowest order of divine endowed, endowed with the potential of immortality. And now I am dispatched from Salvington, one time a mortal of origin on an evolutionary world of space, to elaborate and continue the recital of the eternal purpose of the gods respecting the ascending orders of sonship, more particularly with regard to the mortal creatures of time and space.
Why don't you read that last one there?
Since the greater part of this narrative will be devoted to a discussion of the three basic orders of ascending mortals, consideration will first be given to the non-mortal ascending orders of sonship, seraphic, adamic, midware, and adjuster.
Okay. All right. So you see, there it is right there. They're reminding you of, as I was doing it up front, where this paper fits into the picture. You know, we've been slowly coming down, starting with deity and working our way down. You notice it did remind you, too, it didn't say the description of the gods, it had a description of the deities. I'm trying to challenge you to, you know, start be thinking in the bigger picture. Section one that it started with was about deity. Section two is about God. You know, you had to go down a notch to get to God in the kind of presentation that you have in the fifth epical revelation. That's how high the hierarchy starts. It starts above God. It starts at deity and comes down to God and keeps coming down and down until it finally gets down to you. Now, that's a picture, again, that's never been imagined before. Something that's more fundamental than God. And hence, in a hierarchical sense, is higher than God. Yep.
These first few paragraphs are really astonishing when you really consider them. We've been taught from childhood that we must wait. We must try to do something here, but it's pie in the sky. It's all going to happen someplace else. And this clearly stipulates that it can start and should start and is starting in spite of us, but we have to initiate it here and now.
And one of the reasons why historically humans have concluded that it can't genuinely start until you get up there,
yeah,
is because that lack of recognition of the mother. You know, there's a genuine, truthful recognition of God the Father that goes way, way, way back. You know, and we've all inherited the philosophic reflection about that fact, you know, and got incorporated into us unconsciously in our early years. You know, that was strengthened, you know, into the evolutionary stream by four previous epical revelations of God the Father. You know, but it's produced a bias, and an unfortunate one, thinking that there's nothing really that can be accomplished here, because you know that the Father is that God is transcendence fact, which means he's above, not below. He's in quote-unquote heaven, not down on earth. So I need to get up to heaven, and then we can get going. Yeah. No.
On Mount Olympus.
Yeah, or Mount Olympus, or something high, something that's equivalent to heaven.
Yeah, right. Of the right religion.
Right. Some, you know, some sort of, you know, why is God on the top of a mountain? See, again, like I said, we've known for a very long time that when you say God, you're basically thinking God as transcendence. So you're trying to transcend the lowly plane as much as you can, as your little pea brain imagination can come up with. You know, you pile up a pile of rocks and climb to the top of it or something. You know, whatever, you know, the biggest thing that you can imagine. See, no, the fifth epical revelation is here to say it's not like that. Yeah, there is that God of transcendence, but there's God as immanence. There's a God that's right here, right down there, lapping at your toes. Okay? God the Mother comes all the way down from that infinite level where the Father is, right down to you and underneath you and upholds you. That's why you stand at all. That's why you can be talking, breathing, anything. The only reason that you can exist is because you're being upheld by that God that's underneath you, holding you up. You know, it's not some sort of a magical thread going up to the Father and you're the puppet on the end of the string. That's not the way it works. Okay.
Yeah, that makes total sense, because if it was just God up there and nothing down here, we'd all be flopping around. We wouldn't have anything.
Right. How could you possibly be stable or anything? Right. Yeah. See, that's right. So you're trying to finally recognize logically that, you know, even though we long have had this idea that we've got to get to the next life or something, yeah, there's a measure of truth to that. To that, you know, we're trying to get into the ascension scheme and get ascended up to the Father. But, okay, there's a other parent, and there's another parent.
Makes this life very.
Okay, that allows for condescension. Okay.
And the mother of all mothers is the eternal Son.
The infinite Mother Spirit is the highest mother.
Which is.
The third source and center.
The third source and center. Mm-hmm. You know,
But isn't.
Yeah, I mean, that gets into a lot of complexity to get into all the levels of the mothers, but. But yeah, if you want the little skinny, basically, the infinite Mother Spirit is mother at the co-infinite level. The eternal Mother Son is a mother at the co-absolute level. So now that mother nature, you know, as existential beings, they're, you know, side by side. But in terms of where they fit into the mother hierarchy, you know, the infinite Mother Spirit is at the top.
It just seems like there's a lot of cultures that do believe in this Mother Spirit as like Gaia. What is Gaia?
Right. See, now, okay, so let's just mention that for a second. I mean, there's also a long, long tradition, especially going back to Cain and the Mother of God cult things, you know, with you know, tied to Eve. Where you have a mother deity notion that floats around in various cultures, okay, but it's an anthropomorphism. It's an alternative transcendent being. Yeah, and that's what I was trying to stress. Your two parents are not just, are not just two different sexes of the same basic idea. Neither of them is anthropomorphic. And specifically, how they really are differentiated is one is God as transcendence and one is God as immanence. One is God that's on the outside of the whole picture, and one is God on the inside. And that God that's on the inside is not standing at just one point somewhere on the inside, like a he would. That God as immanence is ubiquitous. every level of God the Mother, you know, stands everywhere at the same time. You know, it's a very different, no human has ever really imagined such a God, a God that isn't anthropomorphic at all, a God that is spread out and still personal, but spread out, filling all of space. You know, the Creative Mother Spirit doesn't merely stand on Salvington. You know, she stands on the arm of this couch as much as she stands on Salvington. She stands everywhere.
Yeah. The ancient, the guy that you're thinking of, the ancient reverence to the mother, the combination of Eve, the Virgin Mary, and it's you can find it in the ancient statues with about 43 boobs all over its bodies.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
that's Gaia. Is that Indian? Well,
no, that's
yeah, I mean, you got to remember here that the webinar crew can't hear all this. So, I mean, but right, I mean, you know, anyone can go and look up all of the ancient mythology, you know, about female deities, Isis or what have you. But you know, but just appreciate that all of those are very anthropomorphic. They're going to have a lot of fertility, you know, God expression, like Don was just pointing out there, you know, and whatnot. See, it's very anthropomorphic. You know, and that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about God the Mother. We're not talking about just, you know, the flip side of God the Father, you know, so that you have not just Osiris, but you also have Isis. You know, we're not talking about Adam and Eve. You know, I mean, the revelation of God the Father in here for the first time actually takes you beyond something that you can directly think of as those Adam-like father deities that our mythology has also. But at least the father idea is still you know, a fact that you think of as located at just one spot. You know, not located at many places at the same time. There is no mother that's located at one place. If God is located at one place, that God is not called a she. That God is called a he. That's why you're calling him he and she. Why are we called ascending sons? Because we're talking about a point that's moving up rather than something that's being a place at a given level. You know, they're using the language to indicate that difference, whether or not there's a localization or not. You know, whether or not it's a womb-like, a God as immanence expression of personalized deity, or is it a localized? You know, so the universal mother that's now filling all of the finite eventually coalesces and becomes a point expression of personalized deity. Then it's called a he. Then it's the supreme being. You know, it's not the universal mother anymore. That mother becomes incorporated inside of a he, and there's a bigger she, you know, that's upholding the supreme being. You know, even God has to be upheld by a bigger mother. You know, so you can say, well, you know, the consummator of universe destiny or something like that, or the architects of the master universe, those are all beings that have to be upheld by a mother that's bigger than they are. You know, there's mother at very, very high levels, and all the way up to co-absolute upholders, co-infinite upholders, a co-infinite upholder. So co-infinite beings have some place to stand. No one stands, you know, unless there's a mother upholding them.
Is the Creative Mother Spirit the one that holds us?
It's immediately holding us. Our Creative Mother Spirit is the one that's upholding us right now, and will until we graduate from the local universe of Nebadon. Then the super universe mother will uphold us. Okay, let's see. Anything else? Make sure we got way off on a tangent there. Make sure we didn't miss anything here. That's right. We should, because he's going to speak in the first person occasionally. Now am I dispatched from Salvington? Okay, you probably, those of you who are longtime readers, don't even have to look at the end of the paper to figure out who it is. It's a mighty messenger, again, since it's writing this paper. You know, whenever they refer to their former life as a mortal. Okay, it's a mighty messenger. All right, so yeah, so now let's go to the, so the, like he said, there, he's going to do the non-human members of this group, of seven first.
One, evolutionary seraphim. Mortal creatures of animal origin are not the only beings privileged to enjoy sonship. The angelic hosts also share the supernal opportunity to attain paradise. Guardian seraphim, through experience and service with the ascending mortals of time, also achieve the status of ascendant sonship. Such angels attain paradise through seraphington, and many are even mustered into the corps of mortal finality. Finish it?
Yeah, yeah.
To climb to the supernal heights of finality or sonship with God is a masterly achievement for an angel, an accomplishment far transcending your attainment of eternal survival through the plan of the eternal Son and the ever-present help of the indwelling adjuster. But the guardian seraphim, and occasionally others, do actually affect such ascensions.
Okay, so like I said, think about that poetry that was up there. The story of these beings from the lowly animal origin mortals of the evolutionary worlds to the personalized adjusters of the Universal Father presents a glorious recital of the unstinted bestowal of divine love and gracious condescension throughout all time and in all universes of the far-flung creation of the paradise deities. The author is first, trying to give expression to the majesty of the fact of what a seraphim can accomplish. As they're saying, far transcending your attainment. Okay, you're given all kinds of, easy, paths to this. I mean, you're given a fragment of infinity, okay, to start with. The angel has nothing remotely like that. Especially a seraphim is just this very low-level, finite creature with no God nucleus. A creature that has to try to somehow get herself into such a ubiquitous, extensive relationship with the universe of universes that she can slowly, one little fuzz at a time, accumulate a ball of reality, that can actually get to the Isle of Paradise. It's a laborious process to try to find these tiny little scraps, that can be accumulated together into something that can get to the Isle of Paradise. Especially, just notice what they just tossed in. They're mostly, telling us, like we saw in the end of the previous paper, they mostly talk about guardian seraphim because it's kind of a more definitive thing. And they're even cheating, quote unquote, a little bit compared to, those and occasionally others that they said there. Think about a seraphim that isn't even able to kind of lock onto you. Like I was saying in the previous paper, you have a spirit fragment in you, and spirit gravity grabs a hold of that spirit fragment and starts pulling up, and you grab a hold of it and get pulled up along, and your guardian angel grabs onto you and gets pulled up along with you. And right. What about those occasionally others that have nothing like that? No elevator, that they can take up. They really are going to have to roam far and wide to try to find that slow, circuitous path that drifts slightly upward over, hundreds of millions, billions of years, trillions of years, perhaps. So, like they're saying there, if you can begin to really reflect on how profound that is for one of them to get to paradise, even a guardian, a guardian of destiny, it follows a human all the way up through Havona, and onto the Isle and gets into the core of mortal finality. They don't get a fragment of the Father. In order to get into a mortal core, you have to have a Father fragment. To get into a finality core, you need a Father fragment. But they don't get that Father fragment until as they're inducted into the core of finality. So they do the entire, journey without a Father fragment. Even those, You know, so if you think about that, that's an amazing feat. I mean, it doesn't even seem like it could be possible. How is it even possible that someone could find their way across such a vast, mysterious divide as it is between here and, you know, in a core of the finality? How is that possible? It's possible because it isn't a matter of trying to somehow see far enough to see the Father and just keep walking towards the light. That isn't how it's done. They can do it because there's God at every level. If they find God at the lowest level where they start, that's step one. And then they find God at the 1 nanometer above that. And then they find God another nanometer above that. God the Mother is ubiquitous throughout the whole vertical thing. If you just take the light and cultivating, consecrating your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother, you technically don't need an adjuster. You don't need a father fragment. All you need is the Mother to get you up. Just step up, one step of the Mother at a time. Okay. The only thing that you technically need to get to the Isle of Paradise is a personality from the Father. You don't need a father fragment. Okay? And that I'm stressing that because there's such a tendency to put so much weight on the adjuster and see yourself as having a really glorious destiny and whatnot. You know, but here are the mighty messengers saying, no, if you want to really contemplate something that's glorious, think about the one that did it without an adjuster, without a father fragment. Now that's cool stuff, he's saying. You know?
They call that a masterly achievement.
Yes, yeah. Right. I mean, to use the words, those two words properly, masterly and masterful, don't bring in the overlord implications of masterful. A lot of times, if you know the difference, you know, you'll say masterful, but what you really mean is masterly, if you were using the language properly, because you don't want to invoke master-slave, you know, sort of image with what you're saying. I'm certain most of the time. And so, yeah, when they mean masterly, they say masterly, not masterful.
Chris.
Yep.
I was just thinking how the midwares have the seventh and the sixth and seventh adjutants.
Yeah.
We have the five plus the two, seven. But it never really talks about what mind the angels are using.
Just a couple times in passing, briefly. I mean that the beings that aren't using adjutant mind or Marantia mind are using some ministry of the kind of the more basic local universe mind ministry. You know, the mind ministry that isn't so specialized and downstepped. Marantia mind and adjutant mind are, you know, specialized downstepped expressions of that more general mind that all of the creatures in a local universe are minded with. And, you know, and we are never going to use that sort of general mind. We're always going to be using specific mind, you know, all the way up until we leave the local universe. You know, it's only when we get into the super universe proper that now we're using the mind that everyone else at that level is using, you know. But as you're ascending in the local universe, you've got an angel that's using that general mind of the local universe, you know, and you have this specialized Marantia mind in parallel next to it. You know, you never get to be plugged in kind of a general way in the local universe. All right, let's see, anything else there?
So it brings to mind that when you finally get your guardian angel, guys,
mm-hmm.
don't blow it. You know, she needs you to get there.
Yeah,
otherwise, she's got to go through all the stuff.
Not to mention, the Supreme is also counting on you, too. And so are all kinds of other beings, yes. I can't recall off the top of my head any other place in the book that has this sort of kind of turning the tables on you, far transcending your attainment of eternal survival through the plan of the Eternal Son and the ever-present help of the indwelling adjuster, you know, you think you could do it without the ever-present help of the indwelling adjuster? You could.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's not your task in the universe of universes to have such an amazing holistic relationship as those beings do with the lower levels. You kind of take a real beeline up through the whole process. You know, just get a slight, you know, little flavor of the whole vertical structure as you're screaming up in the elevator, okay? And it's only when you get to the top that you really spread out and get a more holistic relationship. But there's some beings that flesh out the lower levels, you know, in ways you'll never, ever be able to do. You know, no matter how many trillions of years you're a finaliter, you're just never going to be able to acquire relationship to the whole down at those lower levels. So someone has to, you know, if they're...
I don't want to.
You know, if someone doesn't have a relationship to the whole down at those lower levels, then none of us are going to get anywhere. No, none of us can transcend the finite unless, you know, you have the whole supreme, not just the ceiling of the supreme, you know. And part of the challenge of us getting into the, you know, the truth of the revelation is to see again, work on that father bias that we have. We have such a bias for the ceiling. We think of the ceiling as being better than the floor. We want to escape the floor. Okay? And it's not true. That's one of the most problematic falsehoods that humans try to live.
That's what we are.
You're right, it's what we're taught. It's because that's the philosophy that we've inherited. It's just not true. You know, the lowliest dirt path that you tread is a divine dispensation because it's literally God.
Enjoy the journey.
Yeah, the mother is just as definitively divine and present at the lowest level as at the highest one. But, you know, just see, there's... You're going to have to really search throughout all of human history to find anyone that doesn't have a ceiling floor bias in their theology or their philosophy. It's, you know, and it's the revelation is here to try to take that on, to get us to break that bias. You know, there's no way you're ever going to have a fulfilling life if you're constantly pining for, you know, eternity, thinking that there's nothing below the clouds that's going to satisfy you. It couldn't be farther from the truth. all right. Okay.
Life for so many people is just a dreadful experience.
Right. You know, you end up just dreading every day waking up and you're howling at the moon like the primitives, you know, howling at the sun. Right. I mean, it's just... Right, it's very problematic philosophy.
Whine about the future and
events. Regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future. That's all you can expect out of life if you try to somehow just hold on to a magical relationship with the Father. It doesn't matter how sincere you are, you're going to be regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future. Vainly hoping for the future without Mom. Okay, yeah.
But it is okay to hope for the future.
Oh, sure, yeah. Right. It's not that you shouldn't hope. It's not a, it's not one or the other, right? It's both.
That's kind of right? The beauty of it.
Right, but it's just, just to appreciate, you know, that.
I meant tomorrow.
You know, why do the heathen rage passage, right. You know, is trying to speak to that. It is all kinds of very devoted religious people that are still floundering. Why are they floundering? They couldn't be more sincere, you know. It tells you right there, you know. It's because you obey not the truth that what you're looking for is at eye level, not at the top of the mountain. Okay, that's your problem. You aren't really living, and so that you're hoping for the future is in vain. You know, another thing that they, you know, bring in this regard, you take the two primary words that come out of Christianity that are so often held up to try to get through the difficulties of life, faith and hope, okay? And They've always been treated as innately valid until you're reading in the fifth epical revelation. And then you notice I'm sticking an adjective in front of those words. There's such a thing as false faith and false hope. Okay? That's, I mean, you know, that would be considered blasphemy, you know, in a not too distant past.
And there's undying.
Yeah. You know, the fact that faith and hope can be false, it's like, no, no, no. I'm certain that all my faith, you know, is true. Well, if you think that all of your faith is true, that means you believe that you're innately divine. That means you just joined the Lucifer rebellion and you didn't even know it. Okay? That's not true. You know, your faith can be false. Your hope can be completely in vain, no matter how sincere it is.
And counterproductive.
Your prayer can be an abomination.
I don't understand what you're saying.
I know. That's the fact that no one understands this, that's what, see, there's no human context for this sort of thinking. We believe that anything that we sense is spiritual is true. And it's not. It's everything except that initial thread that's given to you by grace can't be anything but false to start with. So, yep.
Can you define the word faith? And can you, are there any nuances or shades?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, but if I define the word faith, the problem gets worse. Because it's, you know, if you think that faith is a word that means belief that's not predicated on any facts, which is what, you know, most people think that the word faith means, you know, a factless belief, you know, so just a credulous belief, how problematic is it if you tack true or false in front of that? But if you say that what faith technically is, and the way the revelators are using the word faith, is a genuine use of your third cosmic intuition with your personality, basically the most profound initial thing that you can do is that faith grasp, and that can be true and false. Now that's harsh, see? That's a rugged truth. That with the sincerest, you know, attempt to do a faith grasp, you could grasp in falsehood. See, that's not something that Jesus would tell people. That's not something to tell the child of God, that their efforts, initial efforts, are really pitiful. I mean, that's a rugged truth. But the fifth epical revelation tells you that. You know, and so if the person you're, you know, trying to give the fifth epical revelation to isn't ready for that hard fact, they shouldn't be told that, right? They shouldn't be told that prayer can be an abomination. They shouldn't be told that.
Can't. Revelation of this nature, that's a hard fact to absorb. Because that is what most Christians or most religionists are holding on to with both fists.
Right, that you know, and of course there's a truth that, you know, because of mercy, you can be hopeless.
Sure.
You know, every effort you can do can be false.
Yeah, right.
And you'll still get there because there's grace and there's mercy.
Right.
Okay? It's not like if you do this wrong, you know, you're damned.
Right.
You know, that's not in play. You're throwing that out before you're bringing in this rugged truth. But, you know, what you're trying to, you know, you want to not only throw out damnation and hell,
yeah,
you want to throw out delusion at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, and get real about this. It is a long way from here to paradise.
Yeah.
And for you to think that you've got it all figured out, and if you just hold your hand like this and grab, you're going to be there, that's complete delusional. None of us have even the remotest idea of the technique to get there. You know, right? As we were stressing in the last paper, none of us actually can even consciousize spiritual doings yet. every time we use the word, it's delusional, technically. None of us know what we're talking about. It's impossible for us to know that, they told us in the last paper. You know, that's why we can't even describe what the angels are doing with you, because you have no clue. You don't know. Your spirit is just a word to you. Anyway, don't want to belabor this, but appreciate that if you really start to reflect on any passage like this, we could talk for hours, see, about what seemingly is kind of just boilerplate that we've read so far. It's all filled with all of these consequences. The fifth epical revelation just upsets every comfy idea that humans have had about how this works. Okay? And if it can really upset all of those false hopes that you've been pinning your faith to, that faith can do something amazing. That faith could actually mature into trust. Instead of convincing yourself that you understand all of this and you're perfect, okay, if you can let go of that, you'll actually, for the first time in your life, there will be a place for trust to come into existence. Trust doesn't exist for most humans yet because they haven't supplied a place for it yet. They're filling the place that's normally filled by trust with delusion, false faith, and false hope. Let go of that stuff where you think that you've done something profound, or that you are something profound. Face the fact that you are at the bottom of the pile and you don't know anything yet. Now trust. You can't see, you can't hear, you can't taste, you can't touch, you can't do anything yet. The only way you can get there is to let go of your delusion and trust.
Yeah. You sit back and watch TV all day, right?
No. Yeah. It's what the world needs, right? It needs some trusting humans. Look how non-trusting we are. I mean, how's government ever going to work if humans don't know trust? Simple things like that.
Trust what? Who?
Trust in the integrity. Right, who, where? Trust in the integrity of the cosmos. And that integrity is not the Father. That integrity is the Mother. Right? Notice why if we only think we have one parent, all we can really realize is faith tied to that father parent. No wonder we don't have much in the way of trust, because trust is synchronized with that other parent that is ignored, you know, or not recognized. The integrity of the world that you live in is not in the Father's hands. It's in the Mother's hands. You have to, you know, find that cosmos that's integrous, you know, and then you will trust. You know, if you know that God is immanent, not just transcendent, and you're trying to jump up to God, if you know God is immanent, then trust is appropriate.
That's the key.
If there wasn't a Mother, trust would be by definition delusion. How could you trust that, you know, your day-to-day life, if all there was this God that was infinitely separated from you and has no connection, you know, to whether or not, you know, mountains come or go? Right? I mean, there has to be a God that's down there with you.
So if I trust her, can I sit under a fig tree and just wait for figs to drop in my head and not do a darn thing?
Can you, if you trust the Mother, can you just lay under, you know, a date palm and open your mouth and wait for the dates to fall in your mouth? No, because the Mother is not existential. The Mother is an experiential deity. The only way to relate to the Mother is in time, is through time, is through a process. One must do something to be in relationship with the Mother. All you have to do is be something to be in relationship with the Father. Being there under the date palm. Okay? All right, you know, how many religionists have tried to do various laying under the date palm sorts of tracks. It's because all they know is the Father. And so, and you know, they're properly recognizing the existential stasis that is the Father. And they're trying to just be static-like, right? No, one must do something in order to be in relationship with the Mother.
So I'll read.
All right, all right. Oh, yeah, yeah. So it's okay. So back to the thing. So we did evolutionary seraphim. Just one thing to note there is that you'll notice they have curious different ways of describing these. You know, it isn't just seraphim, material sons, midwayers. You have evolutionary seraphim, ascending material sons, and translated midwayers. You know, these different ways. So the evolutionary thing, normally seraphim are not upwardly mobile, right? Normally seraphim are more stationary-like. And even though they're evolving, notice that it's kind of an interesting thing that they would call that, when they actually start moving upward, they call that evolutionary. So, you know, they're saying that there's various shades. There's evolutionary, and then there's evolutionary, okay? There's sort of filling out the horizontal of evolution, and then there's engaging the vertical of evolution. And biologic evolution has those two domains. The gradually in biologic evolution is the horizontal evolution, the kind that Darwin recognized. But the vertical part is the part that he didn't recognize and tried to rationalize with the horizontal. Okay, now that upward movement where you go from one set of species to new species that weren't there before, you know, the origin of species is an upward movement, not a horizontal movement. Okay, see, so that's what they mean here, is now they're evolutionary in the full three-dimensional sense, not just the two-dimensional sense that they're born into. So that's the idea there. We've got questions all over the place. I see, did you?
No.
See, who had, someone over here, didn't they? Okay, just okay. Well, this is Pam first.
I was there first, go ahead.
Oh, he was there.
No.
Yeah,
hers is
from
my
eye. Now, just so that I can go home at peace,
mm-hmm.
Okay, and not be upset.
It's gonna be rough anyway.
Not be upset.
Yeah.
When,
and never come
and
back.
And I'm, you know, I'm a child of God. I'm not an adult of God, evidently, because I cannot look upon, when I pray to God. I can stand on, I can understand standing on the Mother.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand because there has to be the duality. Otherwise, there nothing exists. I can mm-hmm. understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But when I pray and when I contemplate and when I meditate on God, I do on God. I don't do on anything else.
Right.
And maybe you said that one time that he sees me as if I'm the only person in the world,
right.
You know.
Right.
So I feel like I have a one-on-one communication with him.
You pray in the unity sense where there is only one God. From a top-down point of view, there's only one God. One God with many facets. You don't have to pray to a certain facet, you just pray to the one God. I mean, one facet technically is God the Father, another facet's God the Mother, another facet's God the Sevenfold, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but that's irrelevant. You pray to the one God. I mean, true prayer is a pure unity fact, so technically it is going to be praying to that one God. What we're doing is just flipping things around. We're not denying that truth. We're saying, well, from the bottom-up point of view, you know, there's individuality. The creative Mother Spirit is not the seventh Master Spirit, who's not the Universal Father, who's not the Eternal Son, who's, you know, etc. But you don't have to know. None of that is relevant to a simple, earnest prayer to God. You know, the fact that when you look top down, there's only one God, that's why you don't have to know any of these details in order to pray to God and have it be possible. There's a way to approach God where there aren't any details. There's just God. And so your path has a pathway to God in our initial child of God simplicity. You know, even the most primitive of human has a pathway to God because of that unity fact. But the individuality fact that you're actually going to be engaging as you go up the hierarchy, well, that's a whole other story. But, you know, you don't ascend as a child of God. You ascend as an adult of God. Right? And so you can get into all the details. You know? So, again, it's just remembering that the fifth epical revelation is not just trying to give information for the beginner with God any more than a Christian service. You know, or Christian theology is trying to give, just for the beginner. A number of their key theologic elements are just for the beginner. The person who's never thought about God at all has been living a completely selfish, debauched life, you know, and then has an experience. And they find God, quote unquote. A lot of Christian theology is trying to speak to that person, helping them to take that first step. And if it's a very simple Christian church or tradition, that may be all they're really focused on, is the first steppers. If it's a more well-developed, maybe been around for many centuries, it's probably grown into a tradition that recognizes not everyone is just at step one. Some people are looking to do step two, and so part of their theology, their prayers, you know, their liturgy is trying to speak to that person that actually has already taken the first step out of a life of selfishness, you know, into someone who's trying to walk with God, you know, and those prayers for the beginner don't apply to them anymore. The fifth epical revelation certainly has a number of things for the beginner. If nothing else, retelling the story of the life and teachings of Jesus gives, you know, allows you to touch bases with all those beginning things that Jesus was doing. You know, and you can, in the big picture, you can recognize that the fourth epical revelation is really speaking to those beginners. But then the number five is greater than the number four. Five is what follows four. Five is what follows beginning.
But in terms of what you or she's talking about, you know, maybe a simpler answer helpful is that, you know, they do say that pray to God, you know. Your prayers will go where they're supposed to go anyway. You don't really have to sit there and think, okay, should I be praying to this being or that being?
Right, which is what I was saying. Yeah, I mean, again, and it's, I'm just pointing out the technicality of why they can say that, because from the top down, there's only one God. So there is no trying to figure out which one to pray to, because there's only one there. Right? So, and that's, we all know that if you're in the early parts, they say, well, now technically, if you're going to try to think about it, you know, it's a pure spirit thing, and it goes to the eternal Son instead of the universal Father. Worship goes there, and you're starting getting all confused and stuff. You know, see, that's if you want to go beyond the beginner picture, you know. But it doesn't make your prayer better or more acceptable if you try to not look at the Father while you're doing it and just look at the eternal Son or something like this. See, there is no such thing.
And they do tell you to pray. It's very good for you.
Right, right. I mean, prayer, even though it's initially programmed in and is at the lowest levels, is also one of the four indispensables of advancing civilization. You know, so that should have, you know, when you start thinking about how, you know, kind of the, when the revelators are saying, well, you know, you ought to mature your prayer life. Well, the flip side of that is, you know, there's only two general phases to advancing civilization, the early phase and the advancing phase, and the advancing phase, one of the four indispensables is prayer. Okay, so, right, that just reminds you, just pray, you know. It's never wrong to pray in any way. Praying to rocks is fine. Prayer is fine, period. There, God has made it so that all prayer, no matter how ignorant, how misdirected, is appropriate. If he didn't make it that way, how could there ever be primitive people that could eventually get from the bottom like they're describing? It has to somehow be appropriate, even at the most ignorant levels. Right. So you have to always remind yourself, when we get into the details, that doesn't negate the basics. The details don't negate the basics. The basics are still in play. There's nothing that you can do if you're sincere that can ever take you away from God. Yeah. All right. Let's move on to step two here.
Two, ascending material sons. The material sons of God are created in the local universe along with Melchizedek's and their associates, who are all classified as descending sons. And indeed, the planetary atoms, the material sons and daughters of the evolutionary worlds, are descending sons, coming down to the inhabited worlds from their spheres of origin, the capitals of the local systems.
And so just real quick, you know, just, and if it hasn't sunk in, I try to be precise about this, but you know, use this opportunity to get it sunk in. The Revelators try to use the language where if they're talking about them on the local system capitals, you know, then you just say they're material sons and daughters. But they reserve calling them planetary Adams and Eves, or in general planetary Adams, because they're descending sons together, the pair. You know, if you're actually going down to a planet, then you use the Adam and Eve thing. But technically, you shouldn't call those that are on Gerasim, in our case, Adams and Eves.
Right?
If that hasn't, you know, hasn't sunk in, just, you know, stress it here so that, you know, that's in place. And you notice they did remind us, you know, when going through those local universe sons, you have the Melchizedek's on top. And so here they actually say Melchizedek's and their associates. So definitely does put the Melchizedek's, you know, as an overarching fact. Okay, so so they're normally kind of, they're stationary like these angels. But then they can do the descending thing. Can they also do the ascending thing?
Let's read on. When such an Adam and Eve are wholly successful in their joint planetary mission as biological uplifters, they share the destiny of the inhabitants of their world. When such a world is settled in the advanced stages of light and life, this faithful material son and daughter are permitted to resign all planetary administrative duties. And after being thus liberated from the descending adventure, they are permitted to register themselves as perfected material sons on the records of the local universe. Likewise, when planetary assignment is long delayed, may the material sons of stationary status, the citizens of the local systems, withdraw from the activities of their status spheres and similarly register as perfected material sons. After these formalities, such liberated Adam and Eves are credited as ascending sons of God and may immediately begin the long journey to Havona and paradise, starting at the exact point of their then present status and spiritual attainment. And they make this journey in company with the mortal and other ascending sons, continuing until they have found God and have achieved the core of mortal finality in this eternal service of the paradise deities.
Okay. Now, oh, yeah, okay.
Do these material sons and daughters, do they have adjusters?
Okay, I was just going to just explain a couple of those things. For those in the webinar, he's asking, do they have adjusters? Okay, so this is you know, a bit of a placeholder here, because they give you a lot of the details about this up in the paper about spheres of light and life. Yeah, and it's going to be a while before we get to that paper, so let me just give you a couple of the basics so that you you know, you can appreciate what they're talking about here. So, oh, and before I do that, before I forget, I'll forget it if I don't do it right. It's interesting that you said biological rather than biologic uplifters, and it struck me, you know, maybe just to emphasize that, why do the Revelators say biologic uplifters rather than biological? You know, why do they use that adjective? It's because it isn't biologic like, you know, which the AL suffix is. You know, it's literally directly biologic, right? They're mating with the evolutionary races. So it's not, you know, they're not just doing things related to the biologic. I mean, they are right there in the biologic. So that's why they use the stronger adjective. Okay. All right. So you've got these Adams and Eves. And you get into light and life, right? You get into light and life, and where was it? Somewhere in there they mentioned the more advancing stages, didn't they? Where in the heck was that? I should have pointed myself to that. Towards the beginning there. When such a world is settled in the advanced stages of light and life, if you actually look at the details up there, any time after the fourth age of light and life, there's seven ages of light and life, okay, and so any time in the fifth, sixth, or seventh age is when the Adams and Eves, you know, can leave. And all the way up to that time, let's say they go all the way into the seventh stage of light and life, you know, so, you know, who knows how many, you know, billions, trillions of years that might be down the road, okay? All that time, they haven't had an adjuster. Wow. Okay? So, you know, they've been like the run-of-the-mill, you know, local universe creature, going, you know, on and on and on for endless ages without an adjuster, even though they're material, you know, and they've been needing the tree of life that whole time, right? Right. All right. So, but when they're ready to let go of the world they've been shepherding all this time, and go into this new mode of ascending, there's more than just a choice to do that in play. They're stationary by nature. You know, remember, in order to become descending, they had to actually be dematerialized and rematerialized, and they're rematerialized at a lower level than what they started. You know, they downstepped a little bit. See, they're literally descended, okay? In order to become an ascending son, so see, this is why they use that, you know, that adjective here, instead of evolutionary or whatever, they, ascending, they have to be literally modified. They call it humanized. Up there, because like I've said, the word human means up out of the humus. It's a word that literally means an upward arrow. They have to be modified into a being that has an upward arrow in their nature. Okay? And then once they are modified like that, then an adjuster can come to them. So think about that. See, what that means is, you know, the adjuster, like I was saying earlier, is this spirit fragment that has spirit gravity pulling it up. The adjuster is given to a being that actually can align with that vertical direction, with that spiritual gravity. If they aren't modified, I mean, you know, you could imagine it's probably, you know, if you somehow, you know, could magically stick this adjuster in there, you know, it would pull at right angles to their nature and tear them apart. Okay? They literally have to conform with that. So they're humanized, it's called, and then they receive an adjuster. And there's a whole bunch of details, a whole bunch of different ways they can kind of get their journey started. But basically they end up as a full-blown ascender paralleling you upward at the local universe headquarters level. Okay. Remember how last time we talked about that primary modified order? Yeah. I guess it's, let's see, where is it? It's up, you know, way up there in paper 49. You know, just to remind you of that, so people can look that up if they want. I gotta get to the paper. So, you know, like I said back then, it's in, you know, it's paper 49 there in the very last section. You know, we didn't stress that last time, but when they said mortals of the secondary modified orders of ascension and mortals of the primary modified orders of ascension, we didn't stress it at the time, you know, but notice it's the word modified, okay? They literally have to be modified, okay? And... And this is what you, you know, what actually has to happen to those material sons. You know, they literally have to be modified, and they call that modification humanized. Okay? All right, so it's any time from, you know, in the fifth, sixth, or seventh stages, they can get modified like this and then start ascending. And they basically start, like I said, at the local universe level and go up from there.
Yeah? Well, what about can they begin that ascent Jerusalem?
No, that's what I just said. See, basically what they do is they start their ascension at the local universe headquarters world.
Right.
Okay. So they're like that primary modified order. Okay. I don't want to go into all, there's some things they can do before that.
Yeah.
Okay. But basically what they're telling you is that they're an advanced nature, so that if they actually go into the ascending mode, they're like those humans in those very late stage worlds that skip over, you know, all of, you know, basically all of the local universe ascension career in terms of being a student. Okay? All right.
Like most of us.
All right, so let's see. Anything else in there? Okay, got a question?
Why did the liberated Eves register as material sons and not material daughters?
Yeah, all right, I mentioned that in passing. Yeah, all right, so let's just stress it again. This is a very important thing. You'll completely misunderstand almost the entire book if you don't understand how they're using the language. They use the word father or son if you're talking about an individual that is mobile, you know, and localized, you know, and obviously son ties you to father, you know, the linkage of the language there. So that if, you know, if you're speaking of your relationship to the father, you're called a son. They call them
whether you're a man or a woman.
Right, whether you're a man or a woman. Because the personality that came from that father is not sex dependent. I mean, personalities have no sex to them. Selves have sex, but not personalities. They're called material sons and daughters initially because, you know, they are definitely, one is the direction like, and one is the place like, you know, and they're literally going to do the biologic mother-father thing, so it's very appropriate to call them sons and daughters. And who are they sons and daughters of?
Like the Adamic race.
Creator son.
Michael, yes.
No, they're the father and mother of the Adamic race. They're the son and daughter of the Creator son.
That's what I meant.
Right? They're the son and daughter of the Creator son. Only, you know, not the Creator son, Creator Mother Spirit, but just the Creator son. Okay, so that's why they're, you know, so it's the local universe father, okay, has sons and daughters, okay, but once the Eve is done with that, doing the mother thing on their world, okay, then they're going to both become, you know, they're going to let go of that place and become this localized individual. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to have its attention diffused over the whole planet. They can just, you know, be really individual oriented and ascend upward, okay, as a son, you know. And again, you know, if you use the word mother, it's not because that God is a female. It's because that God expression is not localized as an individual. It's spread out over a large stretch of space, okay, maybe the entire cosmos infinite, if you're talking about the infinite mother spirit, right, spread over a very large place. Okay, so that's the language. It has nothing to do well, this was written a long time ago, and so they're using like biblical, you know, father biased language or something like that. Or even, you know, saying, well, you know, how can we expect not to use father biased language if all we've had is revelations of God the Father? You know, all that, you know, is not relevant, you know. They're using it to try to help you to understand, you know, none of us are ascending as males and females. We leave the male and female thing behind, you know, in very short order. You know, we're all ascending as local universe, initially local universe creatures. And they're calling us sons because they're speaking to our relationship to the Father. We're ascending, we're not ascending to God the Mother. We're ascending to God the Father. So they're speaking to that direction, that line you're on. Okay. If they want to talk about, you know, anywhere in the whole ascension career, high or low, if they want to talk about your relationship to God the Mother at that level, they'll call you a child of God the Mother. But if they want to talk about your relationship to the Father, they'll call you a son of the Father. Okay. All right. Let's see. Anything? Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, you see at the end there, because they are very definitively material sons and daughters, they're just going to go into the core of mortal finality. You know, they're very much like us. So unlike the evolutionary seraphim that can go into all kinds of different finality cores, the material sons are just going into the material one once they get to the end of their ascension. All right, next group here.
Translated midwares. Although deprived of the immediate benefits of the planetary bestowals of the descending sons of God, though the paradise ascent is long deferred, nevertheless, soon after an evolutionary planet has attained the intermediate apex of light and life, if not before, both groups of midway creatures are released from planetary duty. Sometimes, the majority of them are translated, along with their human cousins, on the day of the descent of the Temple of Light and the elevation of the planetary prince to the dignity of planetary sovereign. Upon being relieved of planetary service, both orders are registered in the local universe as ascending sons of God and immediately begin the long paradise ascent by the very roots ordained for the progression of the mortal races of the material worlds. The primary group are destined to various finality core, but the secondary or Adamic midwayers are all routed for enrollment in the mortal core of finality.
Yeah, and that it's plural there. It's finality cores.
My cores.
Yeah.
Funny because in the Marine Corps they're spelled the same way.
Well, no, I mean it's spelled the same way, but it's core or cores. You just have to know which way to pronounce it, whether it's plural or singular. See, and it's plural the first time and singular the second time.
The secondaries are only in the
mortal core of finality.
Yeah, not cores.
But the previous one is the primary group are destined for various finality or cores.
Okay.
See, various finality or cores. All right. There's a whole, no, it's just one paragraph, but they've got a whole bunch of details in there.
Really?
Okay, so let's step through them. Because again, a lot of this is expanded upon up there in the Light and Life paper. And let's give you a little sense. It starts off with this kind of a zinger.
Yeah, really.
Although deprived of the immediate benefits of the planetary bestowals of the ascending sons of God. Okay, though the paradise ascent is long deferred. Okay, so if you've wondered about this, you know, forget about rebellions and defaults and this sort of stuff, but just in a normal world, how do the midwayers on a normal world relate to the planetary mortal epics? Well, now, obviously, they have a lot of connection to the first, you know, with the planetary prince, because, you know, the primary midwayers, you know, are coming from the prince's staff. Okay, so they certainly benefit from the first epical revelation to those worlds. That's how they were born. That's how they came into existence, was via the prince's staff, the primary ones. And of course, obviously the same way with the secondary midwayers. One way or another, they come into existence via the Adamic dispensation. Okay, but beyond that, beyond their origin, you know, like right now, the midwares on this planet, the Spirit of Truth was poured out upon all flesh. That didn't allow them to get midwares. You know, you're not even sure exactly, you know, how much can they even benefit from the Spirit of Truth? You know, and that brings in a general question. How much do, you know, seraphim or any other beings benefit from the Spirit of Truth? See, if you think about it, that's kind of an unaddressed issue, exactly how that spirit ministry influences non-mortals. I don't really know the answer to that. But
they must have partaken in, because they wrote all about Jesus, so they must have been here and partaken of a the actual life as it...
Oh, sure, yeah, they observed his life and everything. But you know, notice how they're...
So they
you know,
the immediate
benefits right. of the planetary bestowals. And so I was trying to pick a really definitive one we know something about. You know, it's hard for us to know exactly what the immediate benefits are of the Trinity Teacher Sons. But we can certainly speak pretty definitively. We know that a bestowal son, you know, pours out the Spirit of Truth. You know, and so that you have universal bestowal of thought adjusters after that, okay? You know, I mean, obviously they can listen to a magisterial son, you know, teach or whatever and benefit from that. But you know, they're trying to get at these very kind of direct things. You know, they're not part of the same culture as the mortals. You know, that it's really the mortals that a lot of that ministry is for. Any more than the magisterial son is ministering to the angels on that planet. You know, that magisterial son is ministering to the mortals. So not the midwares, not the angels, not the whatevers. You know, not the visitors or anything else. Okay, that's what they're trying to get at. Okay, and you just
Even
may not...
They may witness
it. Sure, they'll witness it and all this sort of stuff. You know, and they can benefit indirectly, but they're just trying to point out, you know, remember to think of them, you know, why did they have the midwares in, you know, included with the angels in that, you know, that one paper we were reading, you know, as a substitute for the unrevealed order of angels? Because see, in many ways, they're like ministering spirits, okay? They're ministering spirits, not the ones that are being ministered to by the you know, various... dispensations. Okay, you got a question?
Well, are you looking at me or the one?
No, you.
All right. It appears to me that the angels, as well as the midwares, are mission oriented. So they're functioning under mandates. Their mission.
Right.
And once the mission is complete, then they can move on or attempt to achieve more experience in order to move on, but the midwares certainly are very mission oriented.
Yeah, so that's a little bit ago when I was talking. That's another way to. I'll explain to the people in the webinar. A little bit ago when I was talking, I was contrasting between the stationary horizontal and the vertical. Okay, and Don just brought in a good way of thinking about that. Whether or not you're mission-oriented or individual-oriented, okay? As an ascender, you know, you're very much, you know, it's about you ascending as an individual. Yeah, you may do some things, you know, along the way, horizontal things, you know, that are ministry-like, but primarily it's you, the individual. It's about you, the individual, ascending, not you doing a whole bunch of things for other people, okay? You know, that's second.
It's all about me.
Okay, that's second.
Again.
Right, and so that's what's the big thing about the second half of your finite career, when you're done with your ascension scheme. Okay, no longer is it about you. You know, now you're about everyone else. You know, you become part of that horizontal ministry. Okay, but, right, so very much so, you've got midwayers that are they set their individuality and their hopes and dreams of one day standing in front of the Father, they set that aside for ages and ages and ages and ages and ages.
That's all right.
Okay? You know, but then finally, the same way with material sons and daughters. You know, for billions of years, perhaps, you know, they set that aside. Okay, but then finally, you know, they get permission to actually think about, well, what about me? What about, you know, augmenting my nature? What about ascending up through the hierarchy and growing in a way that I can't? Doing this ministry, it's very fulfilling and everything, but I'm basically the same size as when I started. I'm still kind of ministering the same way that I did when I started because I haven't, you know, I haven't grown in the way that you can only grow when you go vertically. Okay, so, yeah, so there, and the way with it works for them is, again, they are modified in order to go from this stationary nature to something that has a vertical, you know, internal orientation to it. And again, they call that being humanized. Yeah, I mean, you know, to use that expression again for the midwares, being turned into these upward arrows instead of these horizontal discs or whatever you want to think of it, you know, get turned into this upward arrow. And they are humanized in the Marantia, okay, rather than the material, like the material sons. Now, secondary midwares can be, I should say this, that secondaries are humanized in the Marantia. I'll explain the primaries in a second. The secondaries are humanized in the Marantia, they say. The secondaries can be humanized in the material, too, if they're going to continue to work on the planet in a different mode. Okay, why can they go either way in being humanized? Well, it's because of what Sidney just, you know, said a little bit ago. Remember, they have the sixth and seventh adjutants, so they have, you know, kind of the more material aspect where you can have adjutant mind, but they also have Marantia mind. A secondary midwayer has the sixth and seventh adjutants and Marantia mind, even though they don't have a Marantia body. See, so there's a mystery there. They have Marantia mind. So most of their mind is in the Marantia mind, and the sixth and seventh adjutants are just sort of augmentations of that, kind of the lower levels of their mind. So they've always had this Marantia mind. They're just modified and given a Marantia form. So their energy system is modified into a Marantia form. And they become just like a Marantia ascender, like we will be in the next life and all the way through the local universe. Yep.
Would that give them at least the potential for moda consciousness?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So the moda, you know, see, once you, you know, notice that one spot where they tell you they have Marantia mind, you go, oh, maybe they can have moda consciousness. Yeah, see, so there's a whole bunch of things that are possible.
And they get a TA, you know, later, right?
You know, in turn, what was that?
They get a TA.
Okay, yeah, all right. So I was going to mention that. Okay, so... So just, you know, just like with the material sons and daughters, or the Adams and Eves, technically, when they get modified like this, humanized, then they can get an adjuster. Okay, so both the material sons and daughters, as the Adams and Eves, and the midwayers, are modified like this, and then get an adjuster. Okay, and obviously with the midwayers, especially the secondary midwayers, you know, they might be a lot more kind of along the lines of the humans, you know, than the Adam and Eve, because they're kind of, you know, cousins,
yeah.
Right? And you see that, you know, what does it say? So. Once the planet gets settled in light and life, you know, initially, you know, that first stage of light and life, it says, you know, that both groups of the midwayers, a lot of times are released from duty right then. So you see, sometimes the majority of them are translated along with their human cousins on the day of the descent of the temple of light, okay, and the elevation of the planetary prince to the dignity of planetary sovereign. Okay, if you remember about that, you don't literally have a temple coming down from Jerusalem down to the planet. Okay, but they build the temple, they bring the plans down and build it.
Transportation.
Okay, right. But that's a beginning of a new dispensation when, you know, when they construct the temple. So there's a dispensational resurrection, you know, of that last dispensation, or maybe it's the only dispensation, of the Trinity teacher sons. That's what they're talking about. They're human cousins. You know, are all those that are being resurrected with a dispensational resurrection out of the last Trinity teacher son dispensation. And so a lot of them are at the same time. Now, here they are calling them translated. They used ascending for the other ones, even though we can see there's a lot of things similar, this humanizing and getting an adjuster. Okay, but you didn't have the descending and then flipping it to ascending, which is why they used ascending for the previous one. Here, they're just going to be translated. They're going to be modified. Okay, there's going to be a translation of their nature. Okay, and you know, you could suspect that probably some of them might be at the point where maybe they actually fuse in very short order once they have an adjuster. Maybe they actually translate in that sense. You know, but whether or not they fuse in short order, I mean, they've got a Marantia body now, so they can be in seraphim and taken to, you know, to wherever they start their ascension. Okay. Now the primary midwayers are much more like angels, remember. Okay? You know, they already have that, they're already using that angelic mind that seraphim, cherubim, and stuff are using. They're not using Marantia mind, adjutant mind, stuff like that. So they're modified.
Still the created mother's mind,
though. Right, I mean, the created mother spirits, like I was saying, that mind, that more general mind, you know, in the local universe is what the primary midwayers are using. So, you know, they just need to be modified so that they can get an adjuster. You know, and they already basically have a spirit-like, angel-like body, you know, and they can be in seraphim and taken, you know. And again, you got this question, you know, how soon do they fuse? I mean, I don't know. Okay. You kind of suspect that with the material sons and daughters of the Adams and Eves, once they're modified, you know, that might be a pretty short order. I mean, maybe they basically almost fuse, soon. I don't know. It's a little, you know, so that whole bit of, if they like go directly from the world where after they're humanized to the local universe capital, they may do that on their own. They may just fuse, wow, you know, in the Marantia temple on their world, you know, and go via adjuster directly to the local universe capital.
You know, all the humans that were in that stage would be just pretty much advanced too.
Right. I mean, if it's seven stage,
fuse like that. Well, the humans don't.
Yeah. Remember, you know, like I said, if you took it all the way to seven stage light and life, I mean, basically every human on a world is fusing. You know,
fusing.
You know, in the seventh stage of light and life. So
special insulation.
Right, but it takes a while. They don't do it.
Yeah, like I said, I'm just tossing out. They don't tell you. You don't know exactly how long it is between them getting their adjuster and fusing. But you could imagine that it might not be too long because you're talking about beings that are going to be quite advanced. Right?
Just a quick comment. We begin to lose that over consciousness of.
Right. So for those of you on the webinar. Yeah, those of you on the webinar, he's talking about how, you know, it's only the humans that have this fixation on time. You know, hence my joke there about when does the study group get over. And he's correct. I mean, it's you don't want to impose your impatience on midwayers and angels. Now, you can assume a similar impatience in an Adam and Eve early on, right? We all know that was our Adam and Eve's problem, you know? They lasted 100 years and got impatient. You know, the same span of time that humans basically have, the longest that humans tend to be able to be patient, you know, it's like waiting for something significant to improve on the planet. It's like, well, we've waited for 100 years, it's time to take up arms. You know, we get completely impatient after about 100 years. You know, if it's not gonna happen in a lifespan, you know, it's not gonna happen and we gotta do something radical. Okay, so, but yeah, you know, a being that has no relationship to mortality, okay, Why can material sons be impatient? Because they're not innately immortal. Okay? That mortality fact, see, injects a tension about time into their minds, okay, that is problematic. Okay? But even a secondary midwayer doesn't have that, you know? They don't have to eat from the fruit from the tree of life. They don't have to worry about getting their mind out of kilter and coming unplugged so that they're not immortal anymore. I mean, they can go rebellion, and they're still immortal. You know, if an Adam and Eve just default, they're unplugged, and they're not immortal anymore. See, they're fragile. That's why they're impatient. And it's like, let's hurry up and get this going, okay? It's that. So just appreciate one of the things that really fuels your impatience. It's your knowledge that you're mortal, and you're trying to cram eternity into a little chunk of time, and it makes you impatient, okay?
It's also our animal nature.
Well, sure, the animal nature has, but I'm just pointing out, I mean, midwayers, especially primary, you know, midwayers, you know, don't have animal nature. And material sons don't have animal nature. You know, so take the animal nature off the track. See, just look at something more, that's what I'm trying to get at, something more fundamental that's tied to the impatience, rather than just, you know, my animal origin nature made me do it. Don't blame everything on that. The really significant things are because of your relationship to spirit, not your relationship to the dirt, okay? The really problematic things in your life is not because you have feet of clay. The really problematic things, the things that are really dangerous and problematic, is your immature relationship to eternity and spiritual issues that puts a tension, you know, into you that can cause a lot of problems, okay? Ask our Adam and Eve, okay? If they hadn't had any relationship to spiritual things, they wouldn't have got impatient. They wouldn't have gotten impatient. And they'd still be here. Okay? It's the same with us. All right. So, with the Adamic midwayers, you know, or the secondary midwayers, as you see there at the end, because they start out, a fair amount like us, when they get humanized and do this ascent, they end up in the mortal core of finale. See, all go there. With the primaries, it's just like with the angels. Maybe they end up in the mortal core of the finality, but they may go into other ones. Other ones are open to them too. Okay, see, that just reminds you again how much they're like angels, and it's. The primaries have more of that positive-negative polarity, like angels, whereas the secondaries have more of the male-female polarity, like humans. Okay, so all those things, are different expressions of the same fact. You know, everywhere from being kind of male-female, like at the bottom, to ending up in the mortal core of the finality at the top. See, there's something very fundamentally similar about them to us. Let's see, anything else there before we do the last little group here? I was going to mention, so the deal with the different ages of light and life. With the material sons and daughters, like I said, it's somewhere, you know, that Adam and Eve are relieved from duty somewhere in 5, 6, or 7, ages 5, 6, or 7. In general, you know, like I said, sometimes they all leave almost immediately, the midwayers, you know, right away at the beginning of the first age. But they can drag on for a long time. But in general, they're all gone by the end of the fourth. So it kind of, see, it breaks it into, you have the first four where the midwayers might be leaving somewhere in that span, and then the last three where the Adam and Eve are leaving somewhere in that span. So that's how they kind of synchronize together. And, think about how that makes sense. They're the, especially with the secondary midwayers, they're the Adamic midwayers. So they're going to leave before mom and dad kind of see do, before the Adam and Eve do.
Excepting on this world.
Yeah. See how, yeah. Right, see, well, you got the orphaned, you know, midwayers on this world. Right, exactly. But that's, you know, that's why you have that basic system. So you can imagine if there's midwayers that are going on, secondary midwayers that are going on past the fourth, you know, which is not impossible. Probably the Adam and Eve, you know, wouldn't go during the fifth. You know, they would go sometime later. You know, it probably is the case that the Adam and Eve always leave after all of the midwayers are gone. Okay. Let's see. Anything else in there? Let's see. Maybe just noticing, speaking to what Don was saying about the mission. Upon being relieved of planetary service, see? And again, they just, you know, it really, those beings that are functioning in a horizontal level, it's very much the case that the work is important and the self is not. I mean, it's even more so than with us. I mean, they're just so totally not supposed to be thinking about themselves. You know, and in a sense, a lot of them joined the rebellion, you know, these various low-order beings, because Lucifer got them, or Kalagasha got them thinking about themselves, and they weren't ready to think about themselves, and they got all wrapped around the axle. They need to just forget about themselves and just do their job, and then everything will be fine, you know. But you start thinking about, you know, and that's where humans get in trouble too, is, you know, you start to kind of get ahead of yourself, and the next thing you know, you've done an oops. Yep.
Now, you know, as we go, the service motive is where we're going to.
Yep. Yeah, so you think about transitioning from profit motive to service motive on a world. Those beings that have always been in service motive probably play a significant role in helping the world do that. You know, if not the midwayers, at least the seraphim, you know, they very much understand that service motive, and they can help to foster that transition. But unlike, you know, we have this bias, historical bias, against thinking about ourselves, and, you know, and that's appropriate to a degree. But remember about your ascension career. Step one in the local universe of your ascension career is getting yourself definitively individuated. You know, you leave Jerusalem, you leave the local system headquarters as an individual. Not someone who's not thinking about me. I'm trying to just spread myself as thin as I can, you know, loving everyone. No, I mean, you need to get solid first. So that's kind of counter to our initial spiritual instincts. Step one is not unity. Step one is individuality. Step two is associativity, and step three is unity. You know, so. You know, when you say the work is important, the self is not. See, I mean, you gotta put that in context. Don't overblow that. Don't absolutize that. You know, there's a context to that. All right. I think there's probably enough on that. Let's keep going here.
Well, personalized adjusters. When the morals of time fail to achieve the eternal survival of their souls in planetary association with the spirit gifts of the Universal Father, such failure is never in any way due to the neglect of duty, ministry, service, or devotion on the part of the adjuster. At mortal death, such deserted monitors return to Divinington, and subsequently, following the adjudication of the non-survivor, they may be reassigned to the worlds of time and space. Sometimes, after repeated services of this sort, or following some unusual experience, such as functioning as the indwelling adjuster of an incarnated bestowal son, these efficient adjusters are personalized by the Universal Father.
Okay. So there, you know, we've talked about this some a number of times. You know, that this is a very significant augmentation of the nature of an adjuster, if they are actually existing within a human that's going all the way to iniquity, that human is going from the level of grace that they started at all the way down to zero, and the adjuster acquires the reciprocal of that.
Or they weren't an adjuster fused human either, right?
But just notice up front there, they're not bringing in that. They're bringing in the full iniquity issue to start with, okay? And so if that human goes all the way to literally zero, into iniquity, that adjuster achieves the reciprocal of that. They go all the way up to supremacy and become a supreme adjuster. They acquire, the reciprocal of everything that human is giving up. As that human gives up their relationship to supremacy, finally completely, that adjuster achieves the reciprocal of that, and gets a definitive relationship to supremacy, as an experiential phenomenon, because they start out as a pure existential fragment. See, and through that reciprocal relationship with that descent of that human, they acquire the fullness, a completeness of relationship to the finite, and become a supreme adjuster. They aren't mentioning them here specifically, but the other way that that John was just mentioning, that an adjuster can acquire some nature of experiential character that augments their existential starting point, is by living in a mortal that's not destined to fuse with their adjuster. And we'll get to that in the next time here as we start to talk about the different types of mortals. But that just can make them an advanced adjuster, to go from a virgin to advanced. But to be supreme, the only way that you can become a supreme adjuster is in reciprocal relation to that individual that goes supremely to zero. Right?
Don't we have a lot of supremes on this planet?
Right. So on a world like this, we have advanced and supreme adjusters. So it's extremely likely that your adjuster lived through at least one mortal that chose iniquity. Your adjuster knows the taste of iniquity directly, right? And like they're saying, remember we touched upon this. They're mentioning it in passing here again. If that mortal chooses iniquity, there is still a quote unquote resurrection. It's that resurrection of the unjust, quote unquote. They build a body. They put the soul, the Marantia brain, into that Marantia body. They do everything. That guardian seraphim has been keeping that soul. It inserts it into the Marantia body, and then they step back, and an adjuster doesn't plug in, and so the body doesn't animate. And then everyone knows, that there's no sleight of hand going on. There's no person there anymore.
It's the real one.
It's an empty husk, right? Just the husk left. Okay, so that's what they're referring to, the adjudication of the non-survivor. That's not just happening, on a piece of paper as a technical thing. It's that whole literal thing of going through all the process. And so if that happens to an adjuster, they get reassigned. And we all know when they start talking about functioning as the indwelling adjuster of an incarnated bestowal son, that reminds us of something that's happened here. We had that adjuster. It was probably a very supreme adjuster that was Machaventa Melchizedek's adjuster. So, that adjuster probably lived through who knows how many iniquitous mortals all over the universe of universes. And then, became the adjuster for Machaventa Melchizedek. Of course, he's not going to fuse with an incarnate son. But got that experience about how to work with someone who's got divine mind in play, not just animal origin mind. And so that adjuster is the only adjuster that's lived in two mortals on this planet. Okay? If you, you know, if you have, I mean, and it's very unlikely that you have a virgin adjuster, I mean, as they say. So, you know, you've got an adjuster that's been in other mortals. None of our adjusters have ever been in a mortal on this planet.
So they ship them out.
Right, they're another planet. They tell you point blank because they want to short circuit that rationalization scheme. Oh, that's my past life thing. Or no, it has nothing to do with that. Okay, there's no adjuster except this one adjuster that was in Machaventa and Jesus, and only those two that was ever in two mortals on this planet.
One was sure, mine was in Caesar, okay.
And what happened? You know, what happened to that adjuster? So and now it's Jesus' adjuster. It helps Jesus all the way through his circles. Gets Jesus to a first circler on Mount Hermon. Jesus comes down off Mount Hermon, going towards the baptism, and literally the day that John is going to baptize him, you know, the midwayers and everyone are watching this, and they know, okay, he's going to fuse today. And they were all kind of getting excited. Cool, we're going to watch a fusion. You know, but the moment that Jesus' soul would have fused with that thought adjuster, the thought adjuster pulled out. And because instead, I mean, that soul is going to fuse with the spirit substance of Michael, which it did. Okay, the adjuster pulled out, went to Divinington, you know, in zero time, came back in zero time as a personalized adjuster.
Not as a dove.
Yeah. You know, represented historically as a dove. And everyone knows it's a representation. No one thinks of that literally, you know, in Catholicism.
Hey,
but that's what that dove, you know, is meant to represent, you know, in many ways. But right, so that, you know, we know very much about that as a personalized adjuster that went through this process that they're mentioning there at the end. And that personalized adjuster, does anyone remember, is now up to what?
The chief of all the other adjusters.
In Nebadon.
Yeah, local.
Yep. That personalized adjuster became the chief of the adjusters in the local universe in Nebadon. You know, so it kind of goes hand in hand with, you know, Master Son. You know, Michael becoming the Master Son. Okay, you know, you focus on all the wonderful things like that, but, you know, from our initial perspective, there's this dark fact, it seems, behind that, how many, you know, iniquitous beings did that adjuster probably, you know, go through? You can imagine how supremely experienced an adjuster has to be in order to handle a creator son. Right? So, you know, it's something that is not often, you know, we don't often remind ourselves of, but that's, you know, that's a rugged truth too. You know, that there has to be a lot of mortals that choose iniquity, or you can't have a single supreme adjuster. You could never have a bestowal son. If there was no iniquity, you could never have a bestowal son. Just think about that. See how indispensable iniquity is to the process.
Includes magisterial sons?
Yeah, you know, I mean, if a magisterial son is going to be a bestowal son, right. I mean, they all have to get adjusted. You know that's going to be a supreme adjuster. Cool. The only way that bestowal son is going to get a supreme adjuster is there has to be at least one iniquitous person in the universe for every bestowal. Look, how many inhabited worlds is there going to be in the grand universe?
7 trillion.
7 trillion. So you have to have at least 7 trillion iniquitous beings just to supply the adjusters for bestowal missions.
Doesn't seem like a lot. It's only one.
You know, but just, you know, I mean, just think about, you know, those are some of the, you know, that God made a universe like that, where there is going to be iniquity. There has to be, or you can't even do bestowal missions. Mm-hmm. All right, let's read the last paragraph here.
Fear not.
Personalized adjusters are beings of a unique and unfathomable order. Originally of existential pre-personal status, they have experientialized by participation in the lives and careers of the lowly mortals of the material worlds. And since the personality bestowed upon these experienced thought adjusters takes origin and has its wellspring in the Universal Father's personal and continuing ministry of the bestowals of experiential personality upon his creature creation, these personalized adjusters are classified as ascending sons of God, the highest of all such orders of sonship.
Yeah, yeah. I was wondering about that. Why would they be ascending?
Right. Well, I mean, what, you know, I mean, they give you kind of the basic description of why they're an ascending son, but you know, you can think about it in a more in an indirect way as well. So there you are, a finaliter. You've got a lot in common with this. I mean, you know, ever since you left your local universe, what your body is what? Your body is that your adjuster. You know, so when you talk about a personalized adjuster, I mean, when all is said and done, that, you know, when you're finally not just perfected but completed, that's kind of what you are. You're a different flavor of personalized adjuster when all is said and done. See? So, you know, when you think about it, when you take yourself all the way through, it doesn't seem quite so odd to call them personalized adjusters. In a sense, they're foreshadowing, you know, what you will be one day as a seven-stage spirit. You know, and you see they mentioned that, starting out with the existential, you know, and then slowly accumulated in an experiential nature wrapped around that existential core. You know, and that's always what your interface, you'll never be able to experience the existential core of an adjuster. That's illogical. You can only experience the experiential. You can't experience the existential. So that existential core is, you know, forever in the endless cycles of eternity is shrouded from you. You know, it's just the foundation upon which you hang your nature. You know, yep.
Well, they mentioned the bestowal of experiential personality. They talk about we have creature personality.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, basically what they're saying. You know, they're saying it in that experiential way rather than saying creature personality, just to emphasize this existential experiential difference. And it just reminds you also that we're, you know, they're not given a creator personality. They're given a creature personality. Okay, but they're, yeah, in this mode, see, they're not emphasizing the creature creator differential of the personality. It's, yeah, they're given a personality that engages an experiential self, just like the kind of personality we get. Yeah, right. Okay, now the difference is the self that's engaged there, you know, is a very vast, profound self. So that personality actualizes as something that technically needs to be called omnipersonal. Okay? Remember, there's this technicality. Sometimes you use the word personality in a generalized sense, but if you can also use it in a specific sense, where personality just means for the finite, superpersonal, you know, for the absentite, okay. What ultra personal for the co absolute, and omnipersonal for the co infinite. Okay, so you know when they say they're a unique and unfathomable order, okay, that's what they mean. Remember when they talk about the personalized adjusters up in the adjuster paper, they manifest, they actualize that personality in omnipersonal fashion. It's not just the tip of that rod coming down from the infinite level that's manifesting a personality, it's the whole thing. And so it literally manifests a co-infinite kind of personality expression. It's up there eye to eye with the Universal Father.
The personality, okay, is of the same source.
Right. So, again, reminding you, the personality, you know, is your personality is for you the whole of eternity. It will one day be able to manifest in you as a co-absolute self. okay, so, but that in this case, see, that because it's just an adjuster, it actually can manifest some of that existential nature personally, and that's what gives it this omnipersonal manifestation. Like I was saying before, that's something that you're not going to do. The fact that you are literally infused into that adjuster downsteps it so that it can only express, you know, at that lower level, at a sub-absolute level. Okay? You qualify it. But here you have a personalization of an adjuster that doesn't have that, you know, downstepping imposed on it. So the personality expresses up the full length of it, you know, and actually comes out the top, you know, as an omnipersonal fact. And so that when it acts as a person, it acts in relationship to all of the eternal past, all of the eternal present, and all of the eternal future.
That's the way,
when that personalized adjuster is doing the dove-like thing, you know, like you were saying, of, you know, being the voice, you know, over the baptism. Okay, I mean, think about how circumscribed that, you know, that personalized adjuster isn't just relating to that time and place in the Jordan there. It actually sees all of the eternal past, the eternal present, and the eternal future in its consciousness. And somehow that's in relationship to that place and time. It's just a completely like an unfathomable phenomenon that's going on there. Okay.
But what could possibly be their destiny? Such high being, such extraordinary.
Well, their destiny, see, I kind of point out, see, the destiny is sort of already in play. I mean, how can you go beyond omnipersonal? You know, they're as a person, they're omnipersonal to begin with, so they have the farthest end from the beginning. As a person. Okay. All right. We went a little bit over there, but okay. So the next time, we'll actually see. You notice that? Yeah. We're actually going to talk about what about me? That even when you finally get to the paper, they make you wait. A little lesson in patience again. But they're finally going to do it. They're finally. But even then, we get into this section. They don't talk about the father fuser like you are until the last. They just keep pushing it. You know, they will finally get to us, and we'll talk about exactly what our destiny is, as opposed to destinies of that are omnipersonal and stuff like this. All right, let's take a moment here.